All right, everybody groan at once. You know the deal. John's memory verses. All right. In the beginning, God what? Created what? Heavens and the earth. And the earth was without form and what? Void. And darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering where? On the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. I put a couple notes up there if you notice the gray font, if you could see it. Elohim, word for God, the Hebrew word for God is what? Plural. So where we get the Godhead, and of course other passages as well. One Godhead, if you will, because the Hebrew word used here is plural. Also, bara, the verb here, means God created, not just created way we might think of it, but created from nothing. God created the heavens and the earth from nothing. Keep that in mind. All right, Genesis 12, verses 1 through 3. Now the Lord had said to whom? Abram. Get out of your country, from your father's, from your family and from your father's house to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great what? I will bless you, make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. All right. Matthew chapter 1. We just talked about Genesis 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. But how about the first verse of the New Testament? It has an impact on this passage in Genesis 3. The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David. Why would the writer mention the son of David? Who was to descend from David? Well, Jesus, but the Old Testament terminology would be the Messiah, that king that would sit on David's throne. Rule and reign forever. New Testament terminology is the Christ. It is Jesus. But he's presenting Jesus as the Christ. And he goes on to say, the son of Abraham. Now, why would he mention that? Our memory verse here. Oh, come on now. There it is. Yeah, number 3. He was the one who would bless all families of the earth. He would be the king and Messiah that would come from David. He would be that descendant of Abraham, would bless all families of the earth. Now, from Genesis 50, remember this is in the context of Joseph being with his brothers. Joseph said to them, do not be afraid, for am I in the place of God? But as for you, you meant evil against me. God meant it for good, in order to bring about, as it is this day, to save many people. It's kind of redundant to me, because you don't want to save them dead, do you? But the passage says, at least the New King James rendering is to save them alive. All right, in the Exodus, Moses said to the people, what? Come on, help me out. All right. So keep in mind, we're in the context of what? The children of Israel being delivered from Egyptian bondage. All right, chapter 19. We're at Mount Sinai. The law will be given in the next chapter, just preceding the giving of the law. Now, therefore, if you will indeed, what? Obey my voice, keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all the earth. For all the earth is mine. You guys keep me going. Keep me straight here. All right, Exodus 40. Then the cloud covered the what? Tabernacle of meeting. Something filled the tabernacle. The glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. All right. Leviticus chapter 11. For I am the Lord who brings you up out of the land of what? Egypt. To be your God, you shall be therefore what? All right. If you notice the gray font there, that's quoted in 1 Peter chapter 1, as we talked about. Now, when the people complained, murmured, the Israelites, are you sure? Yeah. Okay. Bless their hearts, as Mark said. When people complained or murmured, it displeased the Lord, for the Lord heard it, and his anger was aroused. Fire of the Lord went out among them and consumed some in the outskirts of the... Good thing it didn't penetrate to the inner part of the camp, but just kept it to the outskirts. Sometimes we find a little oddity, if you will, to how God operates, but he just got those on the outskirts for reasons he knows best, but that's how it worked. Numbers chapter 20. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, because you did not believe me. To what? To hallow me in the eyes of the children of Israel. Therefore you should not bring this assembly into the land that I have given them. What's our context here for this passage in Numbers 20? Moses did something to that rock. Struck it. And God told him to what? Speak to it. And said, must we fetch water? Remember? That seems to be the nature of the charge here that God brings against him. Now, we're in Deuteronomy. You shall therefore love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, all your strength, or your might. All right, quoted several times in the New Testament. In the context of the land promise, Joshua chapter 21, not a thing failed of any good thing which the Lord has spoken to the house of Israel. All came to pass. Remember, we're in the context specifically of the land promise. All came to pass. All right, the last one. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And we asked the question, well, how did this work out? Not well. Not a good story. And that's what we're studying. So, Paul? We find out that later, don't we? When the people asked for Samuel for a king, like the nations around them, God already reminds Samuel, remind the people, they've got a king, which would be God, as Paul said. All right. I don't know how well you can see this. I can see it better probably than you can. I'm looking at the screen in the back. This one looks better. All right, this gives us a layout of the land of Israel. Just imagine if you could stand here and look at the land northward. You stand just about maybe a little above sea level, what the land would look like. Then I want you to imagine what the land would look like if you could stand right here along the Transjordan Plateau, if it extends up that far. But look across the Sea of Kinnereth or the Sea of Galilee across to the Mediterranean. Wonder what it would look like. You ever wonder that? I wonder about these things sometimes. Here's that southern view, looking to the land. If you look here, you've got the Dead Sea, about 1,300 feet below sea level, close to it. You've got Jerusalem, 2,500 feet. John talked about that slope, both from the Transjordan side over here on the eastern side, which is actually higher than this side, about 1,000 feet higher. So you're looking at quite a 5,000 feet drop here, 4,000 feet elevation coming up this side. The Shephelah, the hill country, the coastal plains here, and of course, here's sea level. I used to tell folks in the Bible class, if you could dig just a trench just a few inches deep straight across here, just a couple inches below sea level, whoo, you're talking about an impact. It would feel all that. Now, this other view that we talked about from the east side of the Sea of Galilee looking toward the Mediterranean. You notice how the Mediterranean level is way up there? Well, that's a true depiction, if you will. All right, something interesting here, this view also gives us Mount Hermon just to the north of the land of Israel. When you get up to that kind of elevation over 9,000 feet, you typically have snow cap all year round. And I haven't been there, Daryl, to have snow cap when you were there. Yeah. I like that because I like going to the Rockies and seeing the snow caps. But this is the Israelite version of that phenomenon. Look at the elevation here you've got. Here's Jerusalem and the mountains through Judea. Not too far west of the Jordan, the Dead Sea here. All right, you've got some of the mountains here. Mount Tabor, it comes up in our lesson this morning as well, here to the east. Mount Carmel's hiding behind Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal. So just something to keep in mind. I like to kind of get a pulse on where we're at in our studies. All right, we've been tasked with looking at the first four judges this morning. Lord willing, we want to look at Judges chapter 3, 4, 5. All right, we're going to start with Othniel. The Israelites, the numbers to the right represent how long they were, how long they were oppressed. Number to the right would be how long they enjoyed peaceful conditions following this. So Othniel, 8 years oppression, 40 years peace, 18 years of oppression. Under Ehud, 80 years of peace. Shamgar, we're not given these details, but we are told his weapon of battle is an ox goad. And this is one depiction of an ox goad. Deborah, 20 years of oppression prior to her intervening in Israel's history. Then 40 years of peace that follows. So I just want to keep this in mind. I've kind of clued it to some of the points on the map as we get to it. That's why Ehud's color-coded and Deborah's bolded. The black circles would correspond to Deborah's story and the blue ones to Ehud's. I didn't put one here, but there's actually should be a blue circle there as well. So I want to keep this in mind. Look in Judges chapter 3. Let's begin looking at the text. We talked about this cycle. Israel sins. God brings judgment upon them, allows their enemies to take advantage of them. Why didn't they drive out the people in the beginning, like they were told? They gained control of the land, but they didn't drive out all the people once the land allotments were made to the various tribes of Israel. They did not drive out all the family groups there. And God said, because you didn't, he's going to leave them there to what? All right, be thorns in their sides and to test them. See what they're made of. They didn't drive them out. You hear a conflict of day today between Israel and the Gaza Strip and the countries around them. And that's not a new story. This is where that story began. If they had taken care of business then, it would be a different story today. Now, there would still be some conflict, but not to the extent that we see today. They never drove out those people. So they've always had that conflict in the land of Canaan based on this. We're going to start in verse 7. So the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. They forgot the Lord their God and served the Baals and Asherahs. This is the male and the female version of the gods of the land. Baal, although capitalized, just means Lord. It's not one specific deity or idol made out of wood or metal or whatever. Not one form, but they formed it according to the various city. Typically, you had one for each city. Each one was different. They looked different according to the whims of the people that made them. And if I'm not mistaken, I think Isaiah 44 talks about that. The very concept of how the idols are made. And they're just made according to the imagination of whoever makes them. Verse 6, therefore the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel. How angry do you think the Lord was? What does hot suggest? Just a little bit? No, he's hot. He's very angry. So, he was hot against Israel. He sold them. Wait a minute, he sold them. Wonder how much he got for them. What was the price? We're looking at the figurative use of the word, obviously, not the literal use. Sold them to the hand of Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Mesopotamia. And I practice saying that quite a bit, trust me. So I could at least get close to it. Children of Israel served Cushan-Rishathaim 8 years. Where is Mesopotamia? He was a king of Mesopotamia, New King James says. It's not on our map. If it was, it would be way up here somewhere where the Tigris and Euphrates come together and flow into the Persian Gulf. All right. It's that land between those rivers. All right. So he's coming from some distance away. Who originally came from that area? Did somebody in Israel's history come from that area? Abraham. All right. Something to think about. What is there today? Who owns that land? I know God does, but that's Iraq, isn't it? Yeah. Iraq. I used to tell people Abraham came from Ur and Saddam Hussein came from Baghdad, which was, you have the two extremes. One of the best men that ever walked on the earth and probably one of the worst. You have the extremes there. All right. So the king of Mesopotamia came against Israel. Overpowered them to some extent. We're not talking probably about the whole of Israel, at least a portion of Israel, for 8 years. The children of Israel in verse 9 cried out to the Lord. Here we go with that cycle. They've sinned. They've been oppressed for 8 years. Now the light bulb comes on and they start appealing to God for help. God raised up a deliverer for the children of Israel who delivered them. Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother. All right. Caleb's nephew, if you will. Let's see where I've got here. Go down to verse 11. Okay. The Spirit of the Lord came upon him. He judged Israel. He went out to war. And the Lord delivered Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Mesopotamia, into his hand. And his hand prevailed. So the land had rest for 40 years. And Othniel, the son of Kenaz, died. All right, so we've got that first judge. Not a lot said. We're given a snapshot, if you will, of his life pretty quickly. God used him, judged Israel. Othniel would have been from down in this area. We're not sure where he met the king, but the king was oppressing. So somewhere they met in battle in Israel. I'm thinking probably in this area. I don't know for sure. Some maps will put him up here. The trade routes come down the way of the sea would come down through this area. He may have met them up here. He may have met them here as they come down the King's Highway, which would go all the way down to Egypt. But he may have met him in this area somewhere. But nevertheless, the battle took place. King of Mesopotamia was defeated. Israel had peace. Verse 12. Meanwhile, what happens after a period of peace? We have this cycle that we talk about. All right. They revert. Children of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord. So the Lord strengthened Eglon, king of Moab, against Israel because they had done evil in the sight of the Lord. Then he gathered to himself the people of Ammon and Amalek, went and defeated Israel and took possession of the city of Palms. All right, let's just think for a moment here. We've got Eglon here. We got Moab coming up against him. It's going to be in this area. All right, got Moab strengthened himself with the people of Ammon. Now, wasn't there something about them when Israel first came up to the promised land that God said about Moab and Ammon?
Moab and Ammon were kinfolks.
Remember that last part of Genesis 19, Lot and his two daughters? Well, that's where the Moabites and Ammonites come in. Amalekites were a nomadic people. They just wandered around. They were among that first group that challenged Israel and attacked Israel when they come up out of the land of Egypt. Later in Israel's history, down the road a bit, that will be the charge brought up against them because God is going to send his first king in Israel to defeat them. Remember 1 Samuel 15, that story about Saul and Agag, the Amalekites? Saul did not kill all the king, or did not kill the king and his family as he was charged. All right, but God would deal with that later. At this time, they come up against Israel. Verse 14, they took possession of the city of Palms. What city is that? City of Palms, close to the ruins of Jericho. So right in that area. All right, so you got the Moabite king, the Moabite people establishing a stronghold there. They're oppressing Israel. If you notice up here, about 18 years, they got a good stronghold there. All according to God's will. Israel cries out in verse 15. Lord raised up a deliverer for them. Ehud, the son of Gera, the Benjamite. What is noted about him?
Left-handed.
Is that totally uncommon? Well, it's not the norm. I think probably if you do the percentage, most people will be right-handed. But in this circumstance, there's maybe a reason that he mentions that. But follow the way. He's left-handed. By him, the children of Israel sent tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. So, Ehud brings the tribute from the Israelites in this area down to around close to Jericho here to Ehud. Ehud brings it to Eglon. Got to get all the E's correctly here. Latter part in parentheses in verse 17. Tell me about Eglon. Little guy? Yeah. He was height. What do you say to that? Height and width challenged, if you will. Yeah, he was definitely challenged. He was overweight just a bit. We'll see later just how, quite a bit. Very fat man, the scripture says. All right, so Ehud brings the tribute, verse 18. brings the tribute, and he finished presenting it. He sent the people away to carry the tribute. He turned back. It seems like he brought the tribute down from the land of Ephraim, from in this area, brought the tribute down to Eglon, was traveling back. He passes the area where they have, hopefully, it's the Moabites have erected these stone idols and not the Israelites, but that seems to be the case. He comes to this area of stone idols and he says, King, I've got a message for you, secret message. King, what's he do? Okay. Yeah. All right. Everybody get away. I want to hear this secret message in private. So he goes to the king's quarters. Let's see where I want to pick up the reading at. I'm going to go down to verse 21. Once they're alone in the king's, I understand the roof chamber, cool chamber up there. Verse 21. Ehud reached with his left hand and under his garments on his right thigh, he had a little gift, if you will. 18-inch, double-edged. I think the New King James says dagger. Other translations say sword. That's a significant size sword. But it's small enough where he could hide it on his person. Wonder why he would mention left hand. If the guards would have searched him, although I don't know that they had a reason to, because they've been under tribute for 18 years, they probably would have taken the normal approach and checked. He's right-handed. He should have one over here. But he didn't because he was left-handed. Maybe they didn't know the difference. Maybe speculation, but nevertheless, the scripture does point it out. He's left-handed. He hid the sword on his right thigh, and it worked. What's a double-edged sword used for? One purpose. Cut. Jab, if you will, but it cuts. Cuts. All right. He thrust it into his belly, latter part of verse 21. Even the hilt. What's the hilt of a dagger or sword? It's a handle part, isn't it? Right. He not only stuck the sword into his very fat belly, but he used it enough force, and there was so much excess skin there, he just overlapped the hilt, the handle of the dagger. It disappeared. Isn't that an ugly image? One thing about God's word, he tells us what I call the good, bad, and the ugly. And to me, that's just, it's a very graphic image. What comes out? Well, what was previously inside. So will it be intestines, intestinal contents, whatever. It came out. So how did Eglon fare? He got his secret message, but it's not exactly what he was hoping for, obviously. So he dies. So what does Ehud do? Locks the doors. Leaves, just like nothing's wrong. Heads back to the hill country of Ephraim. What's he do when he gets there? Let's see. Verse 28. Well, 27. He blows the trumpet. The mountains of Ephraim, the children of Israel, went down from him with the mountains, and he led them. He said, follow me. The Lord has delivered your enemies, the Moabites, into your hand. So they went down after him. They seized the fords of the river. So there's some low places, natural low places, where you could cross during low water conditions. You have those on rivers. They covered the fords so that the Moabites and the Ammonites and the people of the lands around them that were in this area could not escape back this direction. They were trapped on this side. So they secured the fords. How many did they kill? But they weren't very strong men, were they? I mean, they were just weak guys, right? What's the scripture say? Verse 29. New King James says that they were all stout men of valor. How many escaped? None. Not a single one. 10,000 fail. What's the result of this? Israel had rest or peace in the land, verse 34, 80 years. Now, go to Shamgar. We don't know where his judgment, if you will, God's judgment at least on the enemies of God took place. We don't know much about him. We're just given one little quick snapshot. Something is said later that kind of gives us maybe just a bit more of the picture here during this time, during the song, chapter 5. Just think ahead. After Ehud, in verse 31 of chapter 3, Shamgar, the son of Anath, who killed how many Philistines? John and I were talking the other day, and he told me, do you envision this Bruce Lee, this guy doing martial arts, and he's got the thing twisting it around, and he's out there just whoop, whoop, whoop? Or is it over a period of time? Well, we don't know. But he did it. This is not just one effort. This oppression continues. Not so much with the Philistine, but it comes out with Canaan in chapter 4. But the oppression continues. He began this process. We'll kind of get more of this, I think, feel for this when we look at the song that's presented in chapter 5. All right, he killed 600 men of Philistines with a what? An ox goad. Now, is that your typical weapon of war? Later we find in Deborah and Barak's song in chapter 5 that there was no sword or spear to be found in Israel. Not among the 40,000 men, not a single sword or spear. Now, it could be they were cowardly and they just didn't want to pick them up and go fight. Or it could be they didn't have any to take. Because there were times in Israel's history they didn't have access to the metal. And that might give us a feel for just how poorly things had gone in Israel. Nevertheless, this is not your typical weapon of war. Who does it remind you of? Doesn't one of these later judges use something kind of unorthodox to defeat the Philistines? 1,000 with the jawbone of a donkey? Is that a weapon of war? With God on your side, will an ox goad work? Will a jawbone of a donkey work? Yes, it does. Why? Because God is on your side. Funny how that works, isn't it?
One small stone.
Yeah. And a thick forehead, even on a thick forehead. Alluding to David and Goliath, obviously. We were thinking about Samson here with that fresh jawbone of a donkey. So, an ox goad, it works. He also delivered Israel. We're not given many details. One little quick snapshot of his life. Very few details. But we're given enough to know what God can do with a judge, how he can deliver Israel. Now, with that in mind, we pick up more details. We head into chapter 4. Let's look at the first 9 verses. Ehud was dead. What's that cycle again? Uh-oh. Children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. So once again, that terminology is used. Lord sold them to the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. This would be way up here in the northern part of Israel, reigned in Hazor. The commander of his army was Sisera, who dwelt in Harosheth Hagoyim. And trust me, I practice that just a bit too. Harosheth Hagoyim. Children of Israel cried out to the Lord, for Jabin had 900 chariots of iron. And for 20 years how did he oppress the children of Israel? What's the word?
Harshly.
Not just a little bit, a lot and beyond. Harshly oppressed the children of Israel. Kind of looking at this area up here with Hazor, and we're not exactly sure where Sisera was from, but maybe this area a lot of folks seem to think he means the Harosheth Hagoyim means forest, land of forest, land of trees. So they're thinking, if you know the geography of the land a little bit and the topography, that may have been an area up there like we pointed to, maybe up in this area. It seems to be fairly close by, not too far from where the battle and the things, the events take place. Now, we've got the setting. Now we've got Deborah. She's a prophetess. She was judging Israel at that time. She was sent under the palm tree of Deborah. So evidently she spent enough time there. She's got an established place that is named after her. She sits there between Ramah and Bethel in the mountains of Ephraim. The children of Israel came up to her for judgment. So pretty much as well, I would understand, she is down in this area. So God is going to use her to provoke the Israelites, if you will, to put a stop to this up here. She sent and called for Barak, the son of Abinoam, from Kadesh in Naphtali. We're not exactly sure where this is. Some put it up here on the map. I think Scott Richardson put this together, and I think he preaches over at Jackson Drive. His name's on the bottom of it, but a lot of folks put it over in this area somewhere. Just keep it in mind that at least it's close to where the battle would take place here. She calls for Barak. She asks the question in verse 6. Has not the Lord God of Israel commanded, saying, go and deploy troops at Mount Tabor. Take with you 10,000 men of the sons of Naphtali and the sons of Zebulun. And against you I will deploy Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, from his chariots and his multitude at the river Kishon. He will deliver him into your hand. Why have you not done this? Or do this would be the charge. Get ready to go to battle. Get 10,000, Naphtali and Zebulun. Now, let's see how this goes. Barak said to her, if you will go with me, then I will go. And if you will not go, then I will not go. I'm a little slow this morning. Help me out here. What's he telling her? She's an established, known prophetess. She calls for Barak. He comes, speaks with her, tells her, the Lord said, it's time to put a stop to this oppression up here by the Canaanites. I want you to meet roughly in this area, take 10,000 men, and defeat Sisera. The Lord will be with you. He said, his response to Deborah, if you'll go with me, I'll go. If not, I won't go. How is one woman by his side going to make the difference? I'm not trying to sound sexist. I'm trying to appreciate the culture that these folks lived under. These men went to war. Why is he so hesitant? How long have they been in oppression? For 20 years, what has happened? Things have gotten worse. If
he knows he's got to have the Lord on his side.
He's got to have, how can he know for sure the Lord is on his side? How can he know for sure she knows the Lord is on his side? It's one thing to tell somebody, you take 10,000 men, you got the battle, and if you're wrong, what happens? To you, nothing happens, right? I'm looking at it from the human side, Paul. All right, we do. But how does the Lord look at it here? Does he say, okay, I can understand your skepticism. I can appreciate your hesitancy. All's good, right? No. The Lord said through Deborah, of course, you'll defeat him. I'll go with you. We'll defeat him. But the honor is not going to go to you. It's going to go to a woman. Now, jumping ahead, is Deborah thinking about herself? No. She's not going to do it. But she, in a sense, she does lead. She gets things moving. Maybe in a sense she does, but she won't be the final one to bring Sisera down. All right, so we've said that. We've got just a few minutes. Verse 13. Now, Sisera gathers together all his chariots, 900 chariots of iron, and all the people are with him. They go to the river Kishon, which is right here on the map. Mount Carmel's here, so River Kishon coming down. Actually flows from, water flows from here westward up to the sea. All right, Canaanites gather together. In verse 14, you got Barak, you got the 10,000. Notice this, verse 15. The Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and all his armies with the edge of the sword before Barak. And Barak and Sisera alighted from his chariot and fled away on foot. He's running like a scalded dog, if you will. He's left his chariots. They're running. Barak pursued the chariots and army as far as Harosheth Hagoyim, and all the army of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword. Not a man was left, right? Not a single woman was left. End of story right here. Gives us an overview, then he goes back and gives us, well, there is one little detail. There was one that actually escaped, but he didn't make it too far. Seems there's a family of the Kenites up here, descendants of Moses' in-laws, that lives up in this area. Sisera goes to the tent of one of those families, thinking he's got security there, because they've been friends with the Canaanites. But Jael is there, and she gives him a place to rest. She gives him, he asked for some water, and she gave him some milk, covered him up, keep him warm. He's tired. I would imagine dead tired would be inappropriate. Well, he's tired, and he's going to be dead here, so. And he says, evidently he knows men are pursuing him. Stand at the door of the tent. If any man comes and inquires of you, saying, is there any man here? Any man in your tent? You're to say no. So what's she do? She stands at the door and guards for him, right? No. What's she do?
And calls him in and says he's here.
Well, actually it doesn't get to that point, does it? She takes a tent peg and a hammer and what? Nails him to the ground, right through the temple. I don't know if it's front, side, right into the ground. How is that going to be compatible with his long-term health? It was not. He died. He died probably about as quickly as you could die. He was fast asleep and weary, latter part of verse 21, so he died. Yes, he did. And then as Barak pursued Sisera, Jael came out to meet him and said to him, come, I will show you the man whom you seek. Went to her tent, and there he was. There's a tent peg, I guess you could say. From this, the children of Israel, verse 24, grew stronger and stronger against Jabin, king of Canaan, till they destroyed Jabin, king of Canaan. This started the effort, if you will. If you look at the last verse in chapter 5, is the song of Deborah and Barak, a victorious song, ends up, you'll see the land had rest for 40 years. 40 years of peace follows this. Now we'll leave the song for John, Lord willing, when he returns Wednesday night. Any comments or questions you have, I want us to think about just a moment where time's up. Here's some consequences, some application we could think about. Consequences of sin. Galatians chapter 6. Be not deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, he'll what? Reap. I'm not a farmer, but wait, is. You plant corn, what's the way to expect to get? Corn. We plant sin, what do we expect? Consequences of sin. That's the way the world works. We know that principle. We put on the full armor of God. You have a sword as a part of that. The Hebrew writer says it's a living, powerful, two-edged sword. It kind of reminds you of Ehud's dagger, if you will. Much more powerful than that. We need to learn how to handle the sword that we have. 2 Timothy 2:15, American Standard Version, says we need to handle it aright. Handling it aright, the word of truth. Keep these thoughts in mind. I appreciate your attention this morning.